throat throbbing, unsaid words, unshed tears. My life depends on it too. Prayer takes wing, a wordless cry. She shakes herself into movement. Water, thread, pot, cloth. Keep moving, slow time. Just a few hours. Surely Lazarus will only have to hold on for a few hours before help arrives. By nightfall, Jesus will be here. By nightfall, everything will be okay. Days later. Martha gazes tearlessly on her family's tomb, listening to Mary's cries. Between sisters, where Lazarus should be, stands Jesus. Mary's pain has found fresh force now their friend has finally arrived. Days of weeping have left her wails raw, her voice ragged. Though Mary's every cry draws fresh blood, it's an internal bleed. A small gasp, a hiss of breath. Not Mary's. Martha turns. Her lips part in surprise. Jesus, shoulders hunched, is shaking with tears. He looks up, meets her eyes, offers a watery smile. She waits for him to turn away, wipe his eyes, hide his grief. But instead he reaches out and puts one gentle, brotherly arm around Martha, the other around Mary, just as Lazarus would have done. He is standing in. The tenderness tears something loose, gives Martha's sorrow a voice. Jesus lets the sisters cry till they're spent, one on each shoulder, bearing their grief, adding tears of his own. At last he hands Mary off to Martha and steps forward. Rolling up his sleeves and clearing his throat, he turns to the crowd of mourners. His eyes are red, his gaze determined. Take away the stone. Shocked into action, Martha steps forward. She speaks low, the relative's eyes heavy on her. Lord, I know you want to say your goodbyes, but it has been 4 days, and by now, she hesitates, thinking, why must I always be the practical one? There will be an odor. Jesus gives her a half-smile. Martha, Martha, he whispers. Didn't I tell you that you would see the glory of God? Won't you trust me? Palms up, she breathes an I hope you know what you're doing sigh, and steps back to her sister. When the stone has been moved, Jesus looks up and says a prayer, draws a deep breath and shuts his eyes, shouts, Lazarus, come out. Jesus turns to Martha, a grin just for her. Time stops. Mary gasps in Martha's arms. In the darkness of the tomb, something moves.
Waiting precedes miracles. Sometimes waiting forces miracles. But a miracle is not a miracle without a wait. When Jesus heard Lazarus was sick, he waited on purpose. Even knowing the dire need, knowing death was coming, Jesus still stayed away because he had a plan. Now a man named Lazarus was sick. He was from Bethany, the village of Mary and her sister Martha. This Mary, whose brother Lazarus now lay sick, was the same one who poured perfume on the Lord and wiped his feet with her hair. So the sisters sent word to Jesus, Lord, the one you love is sick. When he heard this, Jesus said, this sickness will not end in death. No, it is for God's glory so that God's Son may be glorified through it. Now Jesus loved Martha and her sister and Lazarus, so when he heard that Lazarus was sick, he stayed where he was 2 more days. John chapter 11, verses 1 through 6. Did you catch that nuance there in the last part? Jesus loved Martha and her sister and Lazarus, so he stayed. So means because. Jesus waited because he loved them. because he had something astounding up his sleeve. A gift, a transcendent moment with Jesus, their friend and Lord. Front row seats, more supporting roles in this, perhaps his most dramatic and deliberate miracle. If Martha and Mary had gotten an immediate answer when they begged for help, they would have gotten a healing, but not a resurrection. They wouldn't have experienced this, their family's greatest and most intimate miracle. Every weight doesn't get a miracle, but some do. Some of mine certainly have, and they are the greatest treasures of my life, my shining moments with God, His arms around me there at the tomb, staving off death. But here's the other thing, a crucial truth. Even when we don't receive the miracle of yes, the last-minute save, the brother walking out of a tomb, we still receive other miracles through waiting. Smaller, subtler miracles. They might not have fireworks and fanfare, but they are miracles nonetheless. The smallest diamond is still a jewel. Waiting lets people love you. When our family moved to North Carolina 5 years ago, we limped into town emotionally shattered. In an unexpected whirlwind of change and loss, we had left our parents, our friends, our life, all while I was still bleeding from a miscarriage. We had suffered so many no's from God in a month, I could hardly eat. When you spend days bleeding on a couch, binge-watching the entire Lord of the Rings extended version series and every available season of Castle because you can't bear the real world, it's bad. It's very, very bad. A week after our arrival in North Carolina, I was invited to take 15 minutes to introduce myself to the congregation where we would be serving for a short time. I wasn't ready. It was too soon. I was still bleeding. I could hardly stand for 15 minutes without getting dizzy. I almost said no. I needed more time. But after praying about it, I decided I needed to speak. The women might not meet like this all together for another 6 months, and by then we'd be packing to move again. So it was now or never. There would be no pretending. I didn't have energy or emotional reserve to stand up there all happy, happy, and charming. I decided to tell the church, these hundreds of women, exactly where we were and how we had come to them. So I stood, dizzy and shaking, and told our story. Yes, all the good God had done for us over the years, but all we had recently lost. I cried. I felt vulnerable. Naked, a little embarrassed. When I sat down, I was swarmed by women offering hugs, tears, and sympathy, their own stories of miscarriage and loss. The next day, dinners started showing up at my house from people I had never met, some of whom I never met. The women in that blessed church didn't let me cook for a month. They just gave us food and gave me time, the time we needed to heal. I am forever grateful. Even when you don't get the miraculous yes, you may receive love, support, prayer, encouragement, comfort, maybe a pie or two. And these are no small gifts. Let's back up 15 years. It's my sophomore year in college at my dream school, and all my thoughts are consumed with Shakespeare, sharing my faith, and a certain boy in a Letterman jacket who keeps showing up to eat breakfast in my dining hall. Coincidence? Surely not. No stinking way. He has to be doing this on purpose. If a girl accidentally shows up to eat with a boy she likes every other day, it's premeditated. It means something. Please, God, let this mean something. One spring afternoon, I'm sitting in my dorm room and the phone rings. Hi, sweetie, it's Dad. Dad and I are very close, but in those days, he rarely calls. He's not really a phone person. Suspicion rises. Honey, I need to tell you something. Worst case scenario disorder kicks in immediately. Somebody's sick, somebody has cancer. Please God, not my baby sister. My heart starts jackhammering in my chest. It's about school. School? What's wrong with school? I just made assistant editor at the paper, I'm dorm president, my GPA is great. I'm in love with a boy who keeps maybe accidentally, maybe on purpose, showing up to eat breakfast with me. School is amazing. In fact, I never want to graduate. Dad says, I can't pay for it anymore. Silence. I'm so shocked, I can't even sputter. Honey, I'm so sorry, he says. I thought we could do it. We've tried so hard. The words tumble together, words like equity, irresponsible, and three other kids. I force a brave voice. Okay, Dad, I know you tried. When we hang up, I'm too stunned even to cry. I can't tell Dad what I'm really thinking. Never once in my life have I gotten to finish a school I started. 2 elementary schools, 3 middle schools, 3 high schools. I always have to leave. It's happening again. For the first time, I look around my school and notice all the BMWs and the J. Crew plaid and realize I didn't grow up the way most of these people did. I love them, I'm friends with them, but I don't have what they have. A few days later, Dad calls back. Sweetie, I don't want to get your hopes up, but some of my friends want to help us figure this out. I'm just telling you so you can pray. There's nothing I can do but pray. It's a little embarrassing, but while Dad does the father thing, I start asking close friends to pray. My entire campus ministry starts praying. I take long walks around the school I love, begging my Father in heaven for a miracle. I even make a secret vow. God, if you do this for me, I will never stop telling people the story. A few weeks later, a $2,000 check arrives, a scholarship from one of Dad's friends. This is no scholarship. It is kindness. We swallow hard. Dad didn't ask for this, but we accept it with thanks. It's still just a drop in the $70,000 bucket, but it's a start. And then Dad calls with an update. Another friend, Art, has a friend, a vice president at a national bank. This man has never met me, never even met my dad, but he is a friend of Art's, and any friend of Art's is apparently a friend of Dad's. A friend of mine. Several weeks later, Dad calls again. Meet me in the financial aid office tomorrow. At the appointed time, I throw on my most responsible outfit and dash across campus. A secretary ushers me into the office of the Dean of Financial Aid, where I sit in a chair and try not to giggle in nervous amazement at the sight of 3 men squeezed onto a single couch. Dad, Art, and Mr. Bank Vice President, whom I have just met for the first time. The dean is smiling this baffled smile and throwing me sideways searching glances like, who is this young lady that all these men come running to defend her? I give him a baffled grin in return. I'm nobody, just a daughter of Sam and a daughter of God. I sit there nodding, doing my best to look worthy and super responsible as 4 men throw around numbers and words as Mr. Bank Vice President waves papers, breaks down my parents' finances, and finally declares, the burden is too much for this family. Half an hour later, we all stand and shake hands. The dean walks us out, promising, I'll take a look and call you in a week. A week. 7 long days to wait and pray. We pray our guts out. A week later, I'm with my family. The phone rings and Dad passes it to me, eyebrows raised. It's the dean calling me. Hi, Elizabeth. I looked over your family's finances and it seems we've made some mistakes in your financial aid these past 2 years. I'd like to set things right. He pauses. The longest 2 seconds in the world, my fate in his hands. How does $18,000 a year sound for the next 2 years? Could you stay in school if we gave you that? I cover the phone, whisper the number to Dad, and watch his eyeballs nearly pop out of their sockets. I take that as a yes. My heart threatens to rocket out of my chest. I try to sound cool, calm, like I'm not freaking out, even as Dad is whispering to Mom, and they're both waving their arms around like adorable little weirdos. Why, yes, sir, I think $18,000 a year might just do the trick. We hang up. I am pretty sure the whole state hears our screams. Every other month for the rest of my college career, I drop by the dean's office. Every time, he stops whatever he's doing and invites me to sit with him, even though I am nobody. I tell him how school is going, how happy I am. Eventually, I tell him about how Mr. Letterman Jacket has declared his undying love and sold his trumpet to buy me a ring. I will never forget the gift those men gave me. My father's friends. Never had I felt so loved by God's church, so cared for by God's people. So loved by my two dads, my earthly dad and my heavenly one. And these words are me, fulfilling my Hannah prayer, my promise to God, telling the world what God did through the kindness of friends for a 20-year-old girl all those years ago. Come and hear, all you who fear God. Let me tell you what he has done for me. Psalm 66, verse 16. When you wait, if you dare to share your struggles with friends, even when they're embarrassing, even when you'd rather keep them to yourself, you open yourself up to receive care and kindness. You find out how much people love you, how much they have to give. You find goodness in unexpected places. Waiting lets you be a friend to others. Thank God, the Father of our Lord Jesus Christ, that he is our Father and the source of all mercy and comfort. For he gives us comfort in our trials, so that we in turn may be able to give the same sort of strong sympathy to others in theirs. Indeed, experience shows that the more we share Christ's suffering, the more we are able to give of his encouragement. This means that if we experience trouble, we can pass on to you comfort and spiritual help. For if we ourselves have been comforted, we know how to encourage you to endure patiently the same sort of troubles that we have ourselves endured. We are quite confident that if you have to suffer troubles as we have done, then like us, you will find the comfort and encouragement of God. 2 Corinthians chapter 1, verses 3 through 7. Want to know one of the amazing blessings you might experience as a result of your waiting seasons? The ability to comfort others who are going through a similar trial. The ability to sympathize, and strongly. The wisdom to pass along the comfort God himself has given you. Even as you wait, even as you hurt, do you see people around you needing comfort? People to whom you can be a friend? Infertility doesn't bring many joys into your life, but for me, it has brought one great blessing. Friendship. Over the years, I have connected with women all over the world who have reached out because they heard I once endured a season of infertility. They are friends of friends, and I count it a privilege to pray with them, hurt with them, laugh together at the horrific humor found in things like sperm baths and ultrasound wands. You don't want to know, friend. Oh, I pray you never have to know. Every time I connect with a new friend enduring the agony of a baby wait, I think, this is God redeeming lost time, bringing good from misery, wringing joy from despair. Those awful fruitless years are even now bearing fruit. How can your story help others? The more open you are about your own struggles, the more you will be able to minister to others when the time is right. You may not be ready now, but maybe one day, when you are traveling a more peaceful leg of your journey, you'll find words to share, stories to tell, comfort to pass on. You will look back with a jolt of joy and think, God is using my loss for good. He is Romans 28-ing on me, just like he promised. Spiritual growth, also known as the part where I eat my words. It might not sound glamorous, but spiritual growth is no small gift. Waiting forges things in our hearts that cannot be wrought any other way. Humility, compassion, patience, depth, strength, empathy. These are just a few of the characteristics waiting has cultivated in me. Do I now look back on the season I spent longing for true love, feeling lost and alone, and think, wow, I'm so happy I waited so long for Kevin? Sort of. Not exactly, but kind of yes. During those years, I learned to walk closely with God, to let Him hold my hand and give me confidence. Do I look back on the years Kevin and I spent begging God to give us children and think, oh, I'm so happy we walked through hell on earth. I'm so glad all my friends had babies before me. I'm thrilled that I spent thousands of dollars on humiliating doctor visits while my friends got pregnant for free by forgetting to take their birth control pills. No, I don't. Can I say that everything that came from those years was good? No, I can't. But I can say that I am deeply thankful for the person I became because of those years, that suffering. I stand forever changed. Waiting has transformed everything. How I look at God, how I pray, how I read the Bible, how I view myself, how I relate to my husband, what I expect from life, how I minister to hurting people, how I parent the children God finally blessed me with. For those things, those gifts, I am thankful. You couldn't pay me $10 million to relive the excruciating baby weight years, but I am grateful for the good they brought later. I recognize that I am still processing my waiting seasons, discovering life lessons, still growing, still changing, still striving to become mature and complete. Again, our old friend, James chapter 1, verse 4. So what can we learn? Who can we become? Who are we becoming, even today, smack in the middle of the wait? Learning and becoming might not sound like fun enterprises. Even if they aren't always fun, they are fulfilling, rewarding. Growth is how we partner with God to make life count, give time purpose. We are not just twiddling our thumbs waiting for something to happen. While we wait, we are actively becoming the people God wants us to be, people we will be proud to be at the end of our days. Let's get practical. What are you most struggling with while you're waiting? Simple impatience, discouragement, self-pity, resentment, envy, embarrassment, a feeling of inadequacy compared to friends who already have what you want, questioning God's love, questioning God's ability to change your situation, all of the above. And don't flip out if you are. I have certainly struggled. I'm still struggling with every one of these on some level, sometimes all at once. The temptations and questions we wrestle with show us where we can grow. Don't pressure yourself to master all the things all at once. Just pray about them and start addressing them one by one, little by little. Let the Bible guide your thoughts, your heart. Open up to godly friends about your struggle. The 2020 myth. People say hindsight is 20/20. I am not so sure. That statement implies that when we look back on our lives and on the journey it took to get us here, wherever here is, we should always be able to say, Now I get it. I see the grand plan. I understand exactly why I had to go through fill in the blank, and I'm just tickled pink about the whole experience. It all makes sense. And you know, sometimes we do say that. Every once in a while, we get one of those spine-tingling aha moments from God when we see, for one sparkling, breath-stealing moment, all the disconnected pieces of life click into place. This needed to happen at this exact time so that this could happen. Oh, the beauty. In that shimmering space, God's genius stops time. The pieces fit. We catch a glimpse of one corner of the puzzle of life as it's being assembled. The clues come together, the plot twist explained, the hero unmasked. End credits roll and the audience stands and cheers. But that kind of clarity doesn't happen as often as we'd like. When I look back on my life so far, hindsight is still foggy. Some things make sense. Others leave me scratching my head. Why did I go through that? Why did I wait so long? I can't see the big picture, only parts. We all have puzzle pieces in life that don't seem to fit. Random plot lines that feel like tangents. Detours to apparent dead ends. We don't see all the things God can see, partly because we're not God, and partly because our stories aren't finished. And you know, I don't think we are supposed to look back on our lives and have everything figured out. Isn't omniscience God's job, not ours? Looking back on my season of unrequited love, I can now appreciate the fact that Kevin and I both needed to grow up a lot before we were ready to start dating. So I confess I am glad we didn't make a mess of things by dating too soon. But here's the thing. If grown-up Elizabeth traveled back in time and said that to in-love-in-college Elizabeth, in-love-in-college Elizabeth would probably kick grown-up Elizabeth in the head. If God drew us a map of our lives' journeys, tracking all our detours and delays, most of our maps would be a mess. I think mine would look like a preschooler scribbled all over the eastern United States at random, though I like to think there would also be lots of smiley faces scrawled along the edges. Our maps would probably show long years spent wandering, circling back, meandering some more, repeating paths, hitting dead ends, off-roading, getting stuck, ditching the car, and hiking for a while. Because life is messy. Life rarely takes the most direct, time-efficient route. Life isn't a movie script written to be resolved in 2 hours with a satisfying happy ending and no loose ends. Life is long. Life is surprising. Life is confusing. Sometimes life takes us places we don't want to go. Sick beds, crosses, tombs. Sometimes God stands outside the tomb and holds us while we cry, mingles his tears with ours. And sometimes, oh glorious day, he flashes a grin, rolls up his sleeves, and wakes up the dead. Waiting Room Reading. For further study, you can read more about Martha and her siblings in Luke chapter 10, verses 38 through 42, and John chapter 11, verses 1 through 44, and John chapter 12, verses 1 through 3. Journal prompt. Number 1. What gifts have you already received from waiting? Have you experienced any miracles or received special care from God or his people? Number 2. How can this time help you to become more like Jesus, more faithful, more humble, more patient, more grateful, more compassionate? Prayer prompt. When you did awesome works that we did not expect, you came down and the mountains quaked at your presence. From ancient times, no one has heard, no one has listened, no eye has seen any God except you, who acts on behalf of the one who waits for him. Isaiah chapter 64, verses 3 and 4, Holman Christian Standard Bible.
Chapter 12. Are we there yet? Abraham's story. So many diamonds. Based on Genesis chapter 22. Abraham creeps into bed beside Sarah's sleeping figure. He can't stop the trembling as he recalls the events of the day. His final broken prayer. Please, I trust. He was never mine. Always your gift. But Sarah, bring him back or else kill me too. His own hand raised and shaking above Isaac, precious boy of promise. Sharp knife, glinting bright sun. Isaac's eyes widening in disbelief, terror, confusion, but still, somehow, trust. Love. Those eyes he still remembers blinking up from Sarah's arms that first beautiful morning. Sarah's laughter, rich and ringing, hour after hour, day after day. Abraham's other hand coming down gentle over Isaac's eyes, closing them himself this last time. His own anguished cry, knife slashing down. Then the voice thundering from heaven, Abraham! Abraham. If Sarah finds out, she will kill him. The knife will fly once more, and no voice from heaven will stop it from piercing Abraham's heart. Fear gives way to the manic laughter of relief. Sarah can never know. Even if he survived her wrath, she would never forgive. He would never sleep in her bed, this bed, again. He can't stop laughing, crying, quivering. If his noise wakes her, she will have questions. He eases out of bed, out of the tent, breathes night sky. Heaven's canopy sparkles overhead, cloudless and clean. He counts stars, so many diamonds. I swear by myself that because you have done this, and have not withheld your son, your only son, I will surely bless you and make your descendants as numerous as the stars in the sky and as the sand on the seashore. Abraham has always believed, past reason, past possible. Now he believes more. He turns and smiles on Sarah's tent, picturing her small form breathing quiet beneath blankets, right where he left her. The sweet sleep of a happy mother with a full heart. Faithful God was, faithful God is, faithful God will always be. He walks past tent after tent after tent, his kingdom. Your descendants will take possession of the cities of their enemies, and through your offspring all nations on earth will be blessed, because you have obeyed me. He never thought he would say it. But he has found joy here in these tents, heard little boy giggles at last, savored the laughter of a wife who swore she would never laugh again. His favorite sound in the world, it never gets old. One day these tents will be Isaac's. With trembling hands, he pulls the ram from the thicket, draws the knife quick across its pulsing throat, weeps as blood seeps. Thank God it isn't Isaac's. Lights a fire. Arm around Isaac, he renames the mountain, the Lord will provide. Tired at last, Abraham tiptoes back to his place at Sarah's side, mind filled with thoughts of his son's future once again. Now he knows Isaac will have a future, a long and fruitful one. Abraham won't see it all with his aging eyes, but he sees it by faith. Isaac will become a great nation. Abraham grins at the thought. Kicking off sandals, he folds his legs up into Sarah's bed. She wakes and scoots closer. "Good trip," she whispers. "The best," he says, kissing her hair. "In the morning, we have to talk about finding a wife for Isaac," she says. "It will be time before you know it." "The Lord will provide," Abraham says, blinking long and slow, feeling sleep's pull. "He always provides." Sarah chuckles and props up on one elbow, her gray braid dangling. "And will the Lord also provide a home, the kind with walls and floors, for our son and his bride?" Did he mention that in any of these elaborate promises he only seems to proclaim when you're alone? Abraham brushes knuckles soft against her wrinkled cheek. His sleepy words come slow. "What can I say? Last time you overheard his promise, you laughed at him, so I'm afraid you blew your chance." Sarah smacks him on the shoulder. "I think Isaac will settle down, love, in the land the Lord has promised us, in houses, with walls and floors." He pauses, gazes with surprising affection around the darkened tent. "But you know, I've come to like this life, these tents." Sarah harumphs and plops back down onto her pillow. After a long silence, a small, muffled voice says, "They've grown on me, too." Abraham pushes up on his own elbow and grins down at her, mock shock in his voice. "Wait, are these ancient ears playing tricks? Are you saying that you can be content, even without the home you've been begging for all these years?" He tugs on her braid. Sarah's exaggerated sigh turns to giggles, girlish and free. She winks up at him. "I'm saying I can wait."
I have camped exactly one night in my life, and it was everything I imagined. Fun during the day, torture at night. Our tent smelled like mildew and Cheetos, campfire, and feet. All night the baby coughed and the hubby snored a duet with the guy in the tent next door. Rain sprinkled all night. Of course, my monthly friend was wreaking havoc on my feminine region, which meant I had to get up several times to squelch across camp through rain, flashlight in one hand, tampon in the other, to the bathroom. That nasty place does not deserve such a lofty title as bathroom. A generous title would be toilet shack, though personally, I would dub it the tarantula-infested open-air pot, a pot that stopped flushing somewhere around 3 a.m. I should know. At 3 a.m., I was awake, negotiating with the toilet. "Please, please, for the love of all that is holy, flush!" Lord willing, I will never camp again. I do not like to tent and camp. I do not like them, Sam I am. But it's more than that. I do not like temporary. I do not like uncertain. I do not like uncomfortable. No wonder I have such a hard time with waiting. Good thing I'm not married to Abraham. He left his home, the kind with floors and walls, and his father's family, the life he had known, and followed God somewhere. He spent much of his life in tents, roaming place to place, never feeling settled. And let us remember that he and his wife, Sarah, were also suffering through infertility. Yikes. We have reached the final chapter of this audiobook, but chances are you haven't reached the final chapter of your wait. Chances are you are still journeying through the in-between places, living in tents. Every day you ask God, "Are we there yet?" One day, friend, you will get there. There might not be where you wanted or where you expected, but there you will be. One day this wait will end. Eventually, you are going to get some kind of resolution. So how do we prepare ourselves to handle God's answers when they come? When God says, "Surprise!" As of this recording, there is something wonky with Google Maps. If you type in Mount Rushmore, South Dakota, Google Maps takes you not to Mount Rushmore. It takes you to Storm Mountain Center, a Methodist campsite and retreat 12 miles away. So many tourists have ended up there, lost and confused, that the center's parking lot now displays a sign. Your GPS is wrong. This is not Mount Rushmore. Sometimes life works that way. We're waiting, we're traveling, and we think we know where we are headed, but surprise, we end up somewhere else. If you had told me 6 years ago that I would spend the next 5 years in coastal North Carolina planting a church and writing Christian books for women, I would have either laugh-cried or fallen over in shock. Probably both. But this is where God's GPS has directed us, and what a great adventure it has been. If you had told my friend Marnie that her baby delay would result in her having two beautiful babies, 6 months apart, one adopted, one a surprise of her own, well, I bet she would have taken an extremely long nap, an even longer baby moon, and started stockpiling diapers. If you had told my friend Carmen that one day she would be half-joking with her husband, Alex, that it might be fun to move somewhere else, go support a small church, and less than a month later, Alex would have a new job and they'd own a house down the road from me, helping me and my husband with our church planting, she might not have told the joke in the first place. Of course, God's GPS for our lives isn't faulty. It hasn't been programmed wrong. When we take unexpected detours, they may be unexpected to us, but they are not a shock to God. He isn't sitting up in heaven, face in his palm, whispering to Jesus, "Whoops, didn't see that coming. My bad." Certainly, our own choices and even other people's choices can sometimes send us on a detour God hadn't necessarily wanted us to take. But even then, Romans 8:28 assures us that our powerful God can take bad choices, foolish decisions, even sin, and bring good out of the mess. In all things, God works for the good of those who love him, who have been called according to his purpose. In all things, surprising detours, lengthy delays, God, who saw them coming, can bring good. When God says no. In chapter 10, I started telling the story of Kevin's disappointing junior year in football, still a tender topic. Let us henceforth refer to it as the scout team incident. 2 years later, after a second year of being overlooked and underused, Kevin decided to give up his last year of eligibility. We were getting married and going into the ministry, so why hang around wasting time on a practice squad when there were souls to save? 3 weeks before our wedding, the phone rang. It was the new coach of Kevin's team. New coach. "Kevin, we want you back." Kevin, choking. "What?" New coach. "Our freshman quarterback is academically ineligible, and we need you." Kevin, I'm about to get married. I'm about to start a new job. New coach. "I know, but we need you." Kevin, "Will you actually give me a chance to play? I don't want to rearrange my life if I'm just going to ride the bench without a shot at the starting job." New coach. "I'll give all three quarterbacks an equal look. You'll get every third rep." Kevin, let me ask Elizabeth." He hangs up, calls me, lots of happy screaming, makes a flurry of arrangements, canceling our entire life, and calls the new coach back. I'm in. So just like that, in a matter of days, we turned our whole life upside down. We delayed Kevin's graduation, postponed jobs, canceled half our honeymoon, rented an apartment, did everything it took to give his football dream one last shot. See what God is doing, we thought. God has been preparing this crazy happy ending for Kevin all these years. It felt like a movie, Cinderella in cleats. Kevin had a great summer practicing with the team. He had to make up for missing spring ball, but make it up he did. Studied long, worked hard, stayed late. Got to know the new coach, learned his system. When the first game rolled around, the coach started another guy but said he would make good on his promise. He planned to give all three players a shot to start, one by one, and then he would pick a starting quarterback for the rest of the season. Third game, Kevin finally got his turn. After 5 years, he was going to start as quarterback for the first time in his college career. It was all over the local news and the school paper, the story of the fifth-year player who came back, who never gave up. Our families were freaking out. Our church was freaking out. A million friends bought tickets to the game. We prayed our hearts out for days. After so many years of waiting and working and praying, even through the scout team incident, surely God was going to give Kevin one of those epic, the underdog gets the win sports moments. They would be making a movie out of it later. There would be Rudy, and there would be Kevin. First series, Kevin, my husband, I'm married to the quarterback, I'm Mrs. Letterman Jacket, runs onto the field. I scream so loud, I lose my voice. Both our mothers nearly faint with excitement. But the defense seems to read the offense's mind, and they stop every play. Second series, Kevin runs back onto the field. I find more voice and scream some more. Again, the defense pushes them backward. Third series, Kevin runs back onto the field. With no voice left to scream, I nearly claw my mother-in-law's arm off. Kevin makes a couple of decent passes, but the defense stops them again. The coach pulls Kevin out of the game halfway through the first quarter. He doesn't go back in. He never really got a chance. I sit stunned in the stands, leaking tears for the rest of the game, brokenhearted for my new husband who has fought so hard, kept a great attitude, honored God, and now been passed over again. I can see his pain in the way he stands, the slump in his shoulders. My heart rends watching him cheer and butt slap the other quarterbacks, even as I know he is dying inside. After the most agonizing three quarters of a football game ever in the history of football games, I wait in our car outside the locker room. Kevin doesn't say a word, just gets in and starts crying on the steering wheel. We sit in the Avenger. The car we fell in love in, the car he drove me to church in all those years, and cry together. The rest of the season is a disappointing blur. Kevin doesn't start the next game or the next. He has a few amazing moments, like when he leads the team to outscore the number one team in the country 25-7 for two quarters, and when he starts one more game late in the season. But all in all, he doesn't get the glorious success we had been hoping for, begging for, expecting God to give. Sometimes we wait and pray and work and do all the things we're supposed to do, and maybe for a little while it looks like we are going to get our way, but we don't. Does that mean the time is lost? That we did something wrong? I say no. Those long, heartbreaking years of working in obscurity, cheering other people on, and serving when he felt mistreated and abused made Kevin a noble man, a humble man, a great man, the greatest man I have ever met. Those years helped him fall more in love with ministry than with football. Those years made him the husband he is, the father he is, the friend he is, the minister he is, the man of God he is. God said no, and it's not like we look back on that answer and jump around, cheering and high-fiving. It's still a sad memory, a disappointment, a scar. But God's wisdom is clear. God knew Kevin. God knew what he was doing. Never forget this. Our suffering becomes our story. God's no's are as much a part of our testimony as his yeses. God said no to Abraham ever settling down in a permanent home, but said yes to a son with his beloved wife, Sarah. Abraham lived long enough to see his son happily married to a God-fearing woman, Rebekah. After Sarah's death, Abraham remarried and had six other children. The Bible says that at the end of his life, Abraham was now very old, and the Lord had blessed him in every way. Genesis chapter 24, verse 1. If you are struggling over a no from God, here are a few tips. Give yourself permission and time to grieve. It's not wrong to be sad, to mourn the loss of something or someone you wanted. Feeling sad doesn't mean you don't trust God or that you are rebelling against his will for your life. Feeling sad means you are a human with feelings, feelings God designed you to have. In time, the pain should fade as the wound heals. You may always have a scar, but one day it won't hurt as much, maybe not at all, when you touch it. Don't pull away from God when you are sad. He still wants to comfort you, even when he doesn't give you what you want. Remember, no isn't a punishment from God or a sign of his anger. Let your no remind you not to seek heaven on earth. Here in this fallen world, we all live with holes in our hearts, people lost, dreams broken, blessings missing. Let disappointment and sorrow point you to the joy that lies ahead, the days when God himself will dry our tears, as it says in Isaiah chapter 25, verse 8, and Revelation 21, verse 4. Don't let stubbornness destroy the life you do have. As Solomon says, there is a time to weep, a time to mourn, a time to search, and a time to give up. Ecclesiastes chapter 3, verses 4 and 6. There may come a time when you have to, or choose to, forfeit the search, give up the wait. Take the time you need to weep and grieve. One day, when your heart has begun to mend, the time will also come to get up again. I pray that you find the strength to move forward, the courage to choose joy, the wisdom not to live in the land of what might have been, and the flexibility it takes to decide to love the life you already have. Dare to imagine a different life. Pray that God plants a new dream in your heart. In time, my friend, as hard as it may be to imagine today, he will. Like Abraham and Sarah, you can find joy, even laughter, in the end. Home in tents. As God restored the fortunes of his people after a long and painful journey, after terrible loss, so can he resurrect your dreams and revive your joy. When the Lord restored the fortunes of Zion, we were like those who dreamed. Our mouths were filled with laughter, our tongues with songs of joy. Then it was said among the nations, "The Lord has done great things for them." The Lord has done great things for us, and we are filled with joy. Restore our fortunes, Lord, like streams in the Negev. Those who sow with tears will reap with songs of joy. Those who go out weeping, carrying seed to sow, will return with songs of joy, carrying sheaves with them. Psalm 126. When God says yes. I share this next story with great joy, but also with some anxiety. Anxiety because I realize many of you listening to this book still ache in the throes of infertility, and I don't want to share a story that adds to your pain. I know how tormented I have been by other people's "listen to how God answered my pregnancy prayers" stories. I don't know why God says yes to some people and no or keep waiting to others. I don't understand why I got a yes to my baby weight when some friends have not. I also understand that my wait wasn't as long as that of some others. For us, it felt like an eternity, but others have suffered longer. This is my story, my testimony, my God with his arms around me before the tomb story. God made me a storyteller, and I am bound to share what stories he gives. If you choose to listen, I hope this story brings not more heartache, but hope and healing. By December of 2004, we had prayed thousands of prayers begging God to give us a child. I had begged, bargained, and blown up. Many nights I woke in the night and soaked my pillow with tears, praying till dawn. On Christmas night 2004, I was just relieved at having survived the day. There had been no children, no Santa, no visions of sugar plums dancing in little heads. Somehow I had made it through without a meltdown and had even managed to enjoy the holiday for what it was, a special time with family, husband, parents, three grown siblings, new sister-in-law. As the night drew to a close, my father, who had been a preacher for more than 40 years, gathered our family together. We recounted blessings from the past year, talked of dreams for the future. Every family member wished for the same thing, a baby by the following Christmas. We shed tears, and as the hour grew late, Dad ended our Christmas by inviting us all to pray for the coming year. Around the circle we went, each of us begging God in turn, "Please, by this time next year, give Kevin and Elizabeth a baby." My family had prayed for us to have a baby for a long time, but never quite like this, united as a family, all in one room, echoing a single plea, "By this time next year." A few months later, Kevin and I began seeing a new specialist who had fresh ideas. That spring, the faintest of lines on a pregnancy test made us scream and cry and dance in the bathroom at midnight and then panic because maybe we don't know how to read these tests and chug more water and sprint to the grocery store at 1 a.m. to buy another test, a digital one that said the word just to be absolutely, positively, no way it's a misfire, sure. I was pregnant. I embraced the months of exhaustion and nausea with ecstatic gratitude. Every time I hung my head over the trash can, I was singing inside. The baby was due December 18th. All through my pregnancy, people teased me, "A Christmas baby, how terrible." But I, in my first pregnancy naivete, was convinced that the baby would come early so I could recover from the delivery in plenty of time for Christmas. We had waited so long to get pregnant, surely we wouldn't have to wait past our due date to meet our child. But December 18th came and went, and the baby only seemed to settle deeper into my womb. December 19th, December 20th, December 21st, nothing. Not a single useful contraction. As Christmas Day loomed, I began to despair. I was never going to have this baby. I had prayed so long to get pregnant, now I'd be the only pregnant woman who stayed that way forever. But wouldn't you know, Cassidy Joy Thompson entered the world 7 pounds, 5 ounces of answered prayer on Christmas night 2005 at 9:46 p.m. But we didn't get it right away. It was several weeks before my mother suddenly turned to me, tears brimming, and breathed, "Do you remember our prayer last Christmas night?" And we realized that Cassidy Joy had been born to the minute 1 year after my family had begged God, "By this time next year, please give us a child." I don't know why God chose to answer that prayer with that timing, But this I know. Our Christmas miracle healed many things in my heart